This week on RSBNB Update, Violet is Blue 2 and 6.5. We sum up this wholesome Christmas quest and share the holiday spirit it brings. Also, we have the festive Night Before Christmas Yak track and much-needed Diango bank changes. Then we ask, is a construction rework in the cards? This is RSBNB Update, episode 808, recorded Wednesday, December 16th, 2020. And a half. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of RSBNB Update. This week, of course, we are here to discuss the wonderful Christmas quest and Christmas update that we saw this week. Violet is Blue 2, amongst other things. But joining us to do that this week, Sirion, you're here because you jumped up and down when you knew it was going to be Violet is Blue 2. You said you wanted to be here to squeal about the quest.
Roar!
Oh, that's not a squeal.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful quest, isn't it?
Oh, it's very lovely.
Yeah, we'll get into the details in a moment, but of course, Tanis, you're also here, as you are each and every week.
Thank you, Shane. Yep.
And of course, if you want to follow along in the show notes, you can find those at update.rsbnb.com. And, you know, we are on Patreon if you want to support the podcast, patreon.com/rsbnb, but more on that later. And, you know, Violet is Blue, too. A Christmas Yak track, The Night Before Christmas, bit of a teaser about what's coming on January 4th, RS at 20, a ninja strike focusing on Diango and the bank, and, you know, so much more as well this episode, but we're just going to dive right into this with Violet is Blue 2. And, you know, I think everybody, when they knew this quest was on the way, realized that they had a lot riding on this because of the huge success of the first Violet is Blue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the quest was a fun little wholesome Christmas adventure, and it didn't take itself seriously, which is perfect for this kind of thing. That's exactly what you want and expect from RuneScape. Any initial fleeting thoughts before we begin?
Nope.
Okay. Well, let's just dive right into this quest. You head back into the snow portal at White Wolf Mountain to go to the Land of Snow. And, you know, to start this quest, you talk to Posty Pete on the other side. And then once you're there, you talk to, I guess this is an imp form? A Posty Pete? Posty? Is that the sense I'm getting, what Posty is?
So Posty Pete explains that every plane world has their own post manager. And Posty Pete is the post manager of our Gillinor. And Posty is the imp that takes care of the post in the Land of Snow.
Now, is it always Christmas time at the Land of Snow?
Yeah.
Hmm. And I guess we couldn't live there forever, right? But anyways, once you're on that side, you begin the quest, and you're presented with a cutscene. And this is the graphical cutscenes that we've come to know and love through the Dragonkin series. And inside this cutscene, you have a series of drawings that look like they're done by a child. And, of course, who could have done these drawings? Well, of course, we know that's Violet. I absolutely love seeing these drawings.
Honestly, it touched my heart, seeing these drawings, which is really strange because it's not like the original quest was, you know, super, super... it was that... engaging. Well, it was engaging, I guess, but... It was not that I was completely emotionally involved in it. It was just an awesome quest.
You have that emotional involvement because you know who did them.
Yeah, exactly. Now that I saw the drawings, I was like, oh, that's... Oh. So I really liked those drawings. It was a really, really beautiful touch.
And, you know, when we were looking through these, I thought that maybe they actually got a kid to do these drawings, but it was actually done by one of the J-Mods.
I mean, they really sold it, though.
Yeah, they did.
Like, the drawings were spot on.
Yeah, they were perfect. They were perfect for what you'd expect from a six-year-old on that. And the mod...
Six and a half.
Okay, fine. Six and a half. The mod that did the drawings was Mod Baking AZ. And he said, "Revelation time. The artist behind Violet's letters is me. I assure you it's not easy to mimic the style of a six-and-a-half-year-old kid. Here, one of the drawings I made to commemorate the amazing time I had working with the team on Raksha and Violet." And it's actually interesting because he did more drawings than what was actually shown in the quest. There's actually another one that he shared on Twitter that is basically a combination of Raksha and Violet is Blue. There's a gigantic dinosaur by the Christmas tree, and it looks as though Violet is riding the dinosaur with her Christmas light whip.
I think we just got a teaser for Violet is Blue 3.
I love you, you love me.
Was that a show over there in Europe?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
Very popular here in the North American side. That would be perfect. And if they wanted to take the Violet character to something non-Christmas related, there you go. Yep. Violet goes to Anachronia and looks for Barney, but winds up doing something to Raksha instead. Oh, God, we're already off the rails here. I'm sorry about that, but... right, so you do this cutscene, and then you walk back to the other side of the hill and head over to Violet's house, and you know you get this wonderful, wonderful greeting when you go in, and it's—I don't know—this cutscene when you knock on the door, the emotion on the kid's face, and the emotive hug when you go in the room is just—it's just wonderful, isn't it?
I loved it. It did feel a bit like coming home. So in a way, like it's almost sort of the adopted family now, right?
Yeah.
It felt good.
And you know what the funnest part was, is that when you open the door on her side, maybe she says maybe it's Santa. And you know what the funny part about that is I have the Santa hat and Santa suit on as it's that time of the year.
Right. So it was Santa.
It was. But as we established in the first quest, one of the things that Violet likes to do is play hide and seek. So you have to play a little game of hide and seek, searching for the map in order to carry on into the next part of the quest. And you need to search through a number of things that are inside the house. And go ahead.
What I really like here is, I think this clue searching really shows the power of micro interactions, which is a term I just came up with. But you know, there's this moment where I know you're looking like a barrel or something, and you found some uneaten cooked vegetables, right? And you ask out loud, like, how did they get there? And Violet giggles. And then Trevor, the dad, is like, "I won't tell if you don't." Wink, right? And that little sentence from the dad, you know, that adds so much. Even though it doesn't impact the story at all, it to me those little micro interactions made the quest feel homely and nice. And...
Oh, don't call it homely.
What? Why not?
That is a different meaning over here than what you're saying.
Oh, okay. Well.
Right, Dad?
The girl complex. Yeah.
Homie, then.
There you go.
There you go. But yeah, that's yeah, it just feels nice. There's a lot of that throughout the entire quest, and I just wanted to call that one out because it stood out for me.
Yeah, fair enough. And you know, one of the things you actually have to search is a barrel of rotting fish under the stairs, and you know, I immediately thought of Tycho when I saw that.
Good smelly thing.
But in any case, you continue your search, and after the search, you find Cole and a carroted set of Violet's map, and then Violet, of course, talks about the snow issues that are happening inside Yeti Town, and in doing so, she's like, "Oh, we need to go get a Christmas tree for our house," but when you go and you go to the Christmas tree farm, you discover that, well, you know, we could, of course, have a Christmas tree for Violet's house, and this could be the quest, but the people in town are having issues with not being able to put up all their Christmas decorations and the like. So that, at that point, of course, turns to I guess we call it the Christmas gift, perhaps? I don't know the right way to describe that, but it's effectively the point in many Christmas movies when people or Christmas stories when people are aiming to do something for themselves, but see that there's a greater problem in their community that they need to fix. And you know, Violet, being the wonderful child she is, aims to decide to work on solving the problems for the Yeti Town, Yeti Village instead.
And Yeti again.
All right. Thank you, Tanis.
You're welcome.
Which tree would you guys have liked to have picked?
Well, not the one we ended up with.
Yeah, we ended up with a really, and I think the terminology they used in the quest was wonky. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is all because the snow imps burned the original tree down in Yeti Village.
Because they added fireworks to the Christmas tree. Not the best of ideas.
No. And, you know, isn't the people in the UK very fond of fireworks at most times for celebrations of the year?
Yes. Sadly so.
Yeah,
can't be more enthusiastic than we are.
Maybe not.
I mean, we make it like it's art. Like the way we blow shit up, it's art.
Yeah, it's perfect. Perfect. So once you find out that the tree is burnt down because of the fireworks, Violet aims to fix it, and you go to the tree farm, and you of course pick out the wonky tree. Of course. And, you know, when it comes back...
The bloody wonky tree.
It's like all crooked and bent out of shape on the top. But hey, I mean, it's a Christmas tree at the end of the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess you're... Janice, you would have experience in this situation when you... you know, turn over control of something like that to a child. You just kind of got to run with it, right?
Yeah, you're you gotta ride it.
Even if the tree that you want is not the one that they want, you give them that power. You gotta kind of go with it, even if it looks a little bit weird, right? So,
if just like you say, what color do you want your room, and they say hot pink or booger green, it doesn't matter. Get your paintbrush out, because that's what they want.
I'm assuming you have experience with that.
I do.
Oh, boy.
So based on, like, I feel that in these interactions, they got Violent pretty spot on. Like, her writing seems pretty characteristic for someone who is 6.5 years old.
Yeah.
Like the way she interacts, like can't speak from that much experience, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah, I don't have the experience either, but sure. Sure. And, you know, I'm wondering if they brought in any new voice lines for her, or if these are just reused voice lines from the previous quest. Because, you know, there's a few roars in there, there's a few giggles and whatnot.
Nothing stood out to me as being new.
Okay, fair enough. And I assume probably when they were doing the original quest, they got probably someone young to do that.
They actually got one of the children of one of the J-Mods in to do all the voice acting.
Oh, okay. Yep. You remember that from the last quest?
Yes, we actually just the day before last, or the week before last, we replayed through Violet is Blue as in our clan, so that's where that little factoid came from.
Nice, all right. And, you know, we'll talk more about that after, because that's actually been something that's been going really well for Clan mm-hmm. Quest. Mm-hmm. So, anyways, you bring back the Christmas tree. There's four things that you need to do in order to effectively save Christmas this time around. And Violet is Blue, too. The first one is returning Santa's list to Posty because it is, of course, gotten stolen by one of the imps. You also, of course, need to work with Assistant Brad to bring the tree back, which is probably the first thing most people did. Is that what you guys did first?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I fixed a nice and naughty list first.
Okay, sure.
So the emphasis Christmas on list. Fix.
Yes. Because everybody wants to be on the nice list, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody...
A little reference here that the names of the four children are the names of the main characters of a TV show that is about a con person who runs a lot of cons.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
I assume it's a British TV show?
No. It's American.
Oh, what's it called?
White Collar.
I've never seen it, but all right.
I happen to be watching it currently, so it stood out immediately to me. Quite a coincidence.
Nice. So there's one of the ones inside that show that are named Brad, Susie, is the point I'm getting.
Not Brad and Susie.
Oh, the little snow imps then had different names.
The Yeti children who stole the naughty list.
Right. Whoops. So, oh, God. Never mind. I just made the mistake of assuming that those children were snow imp children. But they are indeed Yeti children. They are indeed Yeti children.
The last one isn't. Neil was a snow imp.
Okay, that's probably what threw me off then. Aye. Anyways, after you've fixed the list, you can put the tree together. You also need to decorate the town for Christmas, which involves going around to various doors and putting decorations on the lampposts and whatnot. And decorating the trees, you got to go knock on those same doors. And as happens when you knock on doors, the dog starts barking. They will give you some free decorations. Not free decorations, leftover decorations. So, and you know that's pretty much the quest, I think. Unless I forgot anything, I think I got the bulk of it, didn't I?
Yeah, you shoot an impling at the Christmas tree.
Oh, right! I forgot about that part. I really enjoyed that part.
That was pretty funny. I thought the dialogue of that was pretty well written.
Because everybody's always wanted to use an impling to do your bidding like that, right?
Yeah.
So that was indeed good fun. I'd like to see that again. And he says, yeah. "Please don't grab me."
Yes. Oh, I thought that was really enjoyable and well written. I always like when they sort of, it's not really breaking the fourth wall, but it's definitely some meta fun in there.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a little surprise when Violet gets back home. So
yes.
Don't forget about that.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. And, you know, you get this wonderful cutscene where you got this weird-looking demented tree, but you also, of course, have all the Christmas decorations up now and the presents restored and the Santa's nice list all ready to go because of you and Violet. But, of course, everybody, of course, needs to realize that, you know, one of the main things Violet wanted when she was going to return home was that there be a Christmas tree in her house. And lo and behold, not only is there that, there's actually decorations outside of the house too. And I think the reaction of walking back in the door with that little bucket on her head is perhaps one of the best parts of the quest, because, you know, she runs into the door and then, you know, you get back inside and you say, well, why don't you take that off your head? And then when you do that, just utter joy. Utter joy. And
there's and a proper, fun music as well.
And there's a proper Christmas tree as well.
And a proper Christmas tree, yes.
Yeah, you're right. The music track at this point was actually very good.
It's, I forget the Violet's name of it. Celebration.
Thank you. I was actually, with that one, feeling tones of a couple of different, you know, modern Christmas songs in there too. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it felt familiar. Did you feel that way too?
No.
Okay,
fair enough. Might just be the instrumentation.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But I like the decorations in the house. I think that this was just the perfect way to end this quest. And, you know, just a fun little story that, you know, I'm wondering at some point, is there going to be a part three or is this done?
I hope there's a part three.
Yeah.
Maybe Violet's going to hit puberty. Going to have a whole a different thing to deal with.
Well, how? What are you thinking?
I don't know. Like Violet emo mode. Violet's black. You know, full emo. Uh-huh. I don't know. No, I hope we get more Violet quests, and I think it's yeah. At this point, we're just sort of coming by, taking her on adventure. We're the cool uncle, right? Or aunt, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly who we are. Except not by blood.
No.
Another interesting part about this is you actually get a necklace and a whip override with Christmas lights on them. And I'm wondering if I could use that as an override with pretty much any weapon, because I think that's how it works, right?
No, it's always good to
one-handed.
Oh, it's only one-handed weapons. Got it. All right, fair enough.
I think it might even have to be the same type, but definitely it needs to be one-handed. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. And one thing that we should have mentioned before we started this one is that you needed to complete the first Violet is Blue quest in order to complete this one. So, and this is part of the reason I ask if there's going to be a part three, is that, you know, are we packing too much into this for what people might just want to come in and play a Christmas quest? At this point, asking people to play Violet is Blue and Violet is Blue 2, rather than just letting them jump into Violet is Blue 2.
It's not a punishment to play Violet is Blue.
Well, some people see it that way, honestly.
But it takes it out of the holiday, like Christmas quest, and puts it just in quest.
Right.
You know, like that's a bottle. I don't even know if I see. I can't even call this a bottle quest.
No, it's definitely not.
No.
No, it's not. But other rewards include a few lamps, a quest point, and the usual treasure hunter keys from this quest. And that is quest complete. Felt wholesome. Yeah. I think we needed that for Christmas, so that's good.
Yeah.
You don't sound convinced, Tannis.
Well, I think this quest started, it had a really strong start, right, with the art and the greeting. It had a really strong start, but I almost felt like it was 25% too long. And especially for a little quick in and out holiday quest. It's just a little, I don't know. It just
took me 40 minutes and I was reading everything with a couple minutes in between where I took a brief pause.
Right.
I must say, like, I cared less for the actual questing part. Like,
yes,
hanging up decorations and, you know, going around and grabbing stuff. That all felt very holiday event to me. Like, could have kind of done without that. And I never cared much for snow imps. But you have to mess up pretty bad for me to not to like a Violet quest, so that sort of made up for it. But
I'm not saying I didn't like it. It just felt a little. It was just a little long, and I thought.
So maybe out of a scale of 10, you would give it a 6, and a
half. Probably like a 7. You know, but, I mean, just oh.
What? Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh! I get it. 6.5.
Yeah.
Did you get it, Shane?
Yeah, because that's all she is.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Don't forget the half. It's important.
I don't know. My benchmark for the two most favorite Christmas events are 2005, where we had the big tree in Varrock and the imps and the factory in Draenor. And I believe it was...
Oh, I love the factory.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. I love that.
And
I still have the how is it called in English? The doll which you move with the strings.
Marionette?
Oh, marionette.
Yes, the marionettes. I still have those.
Yeah.
That was a good year.
Oh yeah. And you know the scarf and whatnot has made it a part of my annual Christmas attire in game.
Yeah, that's probably my most memorable Christmas event.
Yeah, and I know there was also one where we had a gathering in Lumbridge. Gosh, what year was it? It was the where we had all the wintry games in Lumbridge.
That one clearly was not very memorable because I don't remember that one.
I feel like it was 16 or 17.
Wait, was it 15? Is it the one with the feast? Because that was, like, my favorite. Had the feast and the deer, reindeer feeding, and snowball throwing. That one?
I think that might have been 15. Was that the multi-part one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was 15, the multi-part one. It wasn't the one where we got to go back and, you know, effectively replay Shadows of Past Christmas Events, because I know many people like that one as well, because it was...
That was 5 years ago, because I think didn't they do that for their anniversary?
Yes, that's right.
So it must have been 15.
No, it was 16. That's the one where you
got the snow globe from the
Past Christmas Event and the like. You know, I could have sworn we had, like, a Winter Games or something out in Lumbridge.
I don't know. Not that I remember.
I'm fairly
certain. The only thing I remember where we got games is with the Olympics. When we got the Olympic Games.
Yeah, the Gielinorian Games, of course.
Yes.
But... let's move on to the next part of this update this week, which is Yak Track, the night before Christmas. And the whole idea, of course, behind this one is that there's a whole variety of winter-themed Yak Track-related rewards that we win from this. I don't know. You guys are both saying that these Yak Tracks are starting to feel a little bit long in the tooth. They did make some changes to those, which we'll get to in just a wee bit. But for me, the Yak Tracks always come down to cosmetics, honestly. And that's the best part of them. And that's why I do them, even though I don't particularly change my cosmetic options all that frequently. So, I mean, they look stunning as they always do here.
Mm-hmm.
Very ice and frost themed, of course.
I think the cosmetics are, it's great. That's actually why I did the last one and why I'm gonna, why I'm doing this one. I thought that the half progress went a little bit further than the.
No, it ends at task 10. That's,
yeah, so that's, I was just a little shocked. I was like, oh, no. but I love these cosmetics. Like that, the night before Christmas, it kind of looks like a. I was telling you guys in pre show, it looks like a winter fey night. It's kind of like it. I'm definitely going to. Finish it out, to get everything.
Yeah, and there's a good, and there's like ice and frost on it too. So, I don't know. They look wonderful, and I think at this point, you're either doing Yak Track because you use it as a way to break up your training, which is what I do, or you're in it for the cosmetics. How do you feel about this one, Sirion?
Yeah, I think the cosmetics are really good, but in all honesty. I don't use cosmetics all that much.
Right.
I'm pretty happy with my outfit, and you can attest to it. I haven't changed it in years. Now. So,
what are you gonna do with perfection?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm not really in it for the cosmetics. I really liked the concept of breaking up training. To me. It was sort of the substitute for, proper daily achievements and daily challenges that
I've promoted so often in the show.
When I was going through last Yak Track, I just realized, okay, this Yak Track is telling me what to do, but I'm now actually doing things that I'm not enjoying doing. A lot of the activities in RS are not actually that enjoyable on their own. at some point I was just sitting there, why am I mining 2,000 ore again? What am I doing this for? Why am I not playing a game I actually enjoy? So, yeah, in a way it felt a bit massive.
Just to be clear, you do enjoy RuneScape. It's just you didn't want.
Second screen.
You just didn't want it to be the main thing you were doing for no reason.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, exactly. I do enjoy RuneScape, but yeah, Yak Track was sort of making me do things that I didn't want to do. So I still think it's a really good tool if you want to play RS. And you don't know what to do on RS, then sure, it's something to go for. It will give you those cosmetics. If you're a cosmetic hunter, I think it's pretty great. But I'm very slowly losing my enthusiasm for it because the second half of it is just so grindy. You're just either spending a bunch of money on it or a bunch of time on it. I could be doing other things. Is what I feel most of the time. During it, and Yak Track was actually one of the first few times that I was burned out on RS as a whole. So,
yeah, you gotta watch when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair, but that's kind of one of the good things about the Yak Track is it feels like you can take it or leave it. I want these cosmetics,
but we know they're going to come to the Oddment store at some point in the future.
Well, right, I don't know. I never felt the thing I like about the Yak Track is I don't feel pressured to have to do it at any one time or even at all. The last two are the ones that I've done all the way. I mean, I've done a little here and there on the others, but just for very specific, items I wanted.
Right.
So, you don't feel that daily skate pressure on. I don't anyway. Personally.
Yeah, and I just want to talking about the pressure, and I just want to actually just look at the rewards on this one because that's an important thing that is often forgotten about these Yak Tracks is that the majority of the cosmetics actually come from the free track. Mm-hmm. If you just wanted, you know, most of the base outfits, you can get those on the free track. You don't need to invest into buying a Premier Pass or having Premier Club to get it for free. Granted, yeah, there are some on the Premier option, but you don't really need that to make a huge progression forward with it. So you don't feel punished in doing so, which, you know, I think it's just perfect that they keep doing that. But we do need to talk about the tasks on this one, because they did tone some of them down, and these are in the patch notes. And, you know, we're kind of just going to jump back and forth and talk about these Yak Track changes with this right now, because lots of people have been saying that some of these tasks are too punishing. And they start off by saying that agility tasks will now allow players to complete any agility course that they meet the level requirement to use, instead of being scaled to the player's level. So if you wanted to, you don't necessarily need to go to the wilderness course to do it. You could just go do barbarian advanced if you felt the same way.
That's good.
Dungeoneering will now allow you to complete any floor that you have the requirement for, so it doesn't always need to be, you know, warp 2 plus, which is absolutely horrible to do when it's like 40 of them.
Yeah.
The quantity of items for herbalore and crafting tasks no longer scale based on your level, and all players must carry out the same number of actions.
That's good.
That's very good, because those herbalore tasks before were absolutely...
Oh, man. Dude, I had to skip them just because I couldn't afford them. I literally couldn't afford them.
Yeah.
I did the math at some point, and buying skips was cheaper than doing the tasks.
Yeah.
Of course, you get the XP, but you get the point.
Eh. And, you know, you see this at task 9, 600 of either prayer or crafting, and those crafting tasks, you know, I mean, it can be anything all the way from, you know, the regular blue and green dragon hide stuff all the way up to the top. So that's good with that one. I'm just looking at the list here. I'm going to try and find a herblore task that is going to be important. Only 1,000 now, rather than, you know, the 2,600 or 3,200 that you would have before.
Better.
No, still 1,500 at task 41, which is not insignificant.
Yeah, it's not insignificant, but it's still pretty steep. But yet again, you know, you're not dealing with north of 3,000.
No. I mean, going through these tasks, some of these definitely feel much better. Like, some of the tasks were never bad. Still, 180 agility laps? Still.
I forget that.
Yeah, so I think, like, last time when I went through this, I sort of came up with, what is the perfect duration for one of these tasks, right?
I'd say about 40 minutes.
45 minutes, I think, is the time I would want to spend on one of these tasks.
One play session.
45 minutes is something I could do, even if it's not necessarily what I need right now, but it's... A small enough task that, you know, that's something I want to pick up. How many of these can you actually do in 45 minutes, though? Like, a lot of them you can, but there's a few. Like, 25 Slayer tasks.
Oh, nope. Yeah, hell no.
That's like 10 hours of work, right? Unless I'm really slow at Slayer, which probably I am. But, like, how many Slayer tasks can you do per hour?
Two?
Maybe three?
Maybe three?
I was going to say four or five, but yeah, I mean, it really just depends.
All right.
So, yeah, like, some of these you can do in 5 minutes, right? That's...
Like the new present hunt tasks.
Kill 3,500 monsters. Like, try doing that you can probably do it in 45 minutes if you want to sink, like... 7,000 cannonballs into this or something like that, but
there's those creatures in the Lumbridge Catacombs with the reflect ability.
Mm.
But I mean, even then, But yeah, I agree. You know, you definitely want something around the length of 45-ish minutes. I think that's the perfect bite-sized nature for these yak track tasks. And then maybe you can have some stretch ones later on in the run. I don't know. No. In addition to reducing quantities for herb lore tasks, summoning tasks are also less restrictive and now allow you to create a wider range of pouches. I've never done summoning for yak track. You guys?
No.
No. And I think that's more of a problem with summoning than anything else, because there's no reason to do summoning north of 99 unless you're going for 120, right?
Well, there's always a cheaper option. I mean, that's...
Yeah, that's true. Because summoning is like the alternate herb lore, really.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I
think you make a good point there. Like, there's no reason to do summoning, and that's the problem with a lot of these tasks, right? There's no reason to do them by themselves, except for Yak Track. That makes them sort of...
Yeah. Like, we're looking at 2280 pouches at task 35 and 2510 at task 47.
Oof. But, like, if you look at, like, other Battle Pass models, like Fortnite or Rocket League, you tend to... get tasks, right, to help you along. But no matter how you play, you're always sort of progressing, always getting sort of XP and pushing you forward on that task. And
that's the difference.
Well, I'm just AFKing archaeology right now. I hadn't started Yak Track, right? But I completed the first three tasks sort of automatically because they happened to be skill and kill two in a row, and then excavate materials, which happen to be the things I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think Yak Track is great. Like, if I could maybe get progress to all of these tasks by doing whatever I want to do, maybe slower, right? Slower than using the prescribed tasks, it would feel like a nicer addition to the game, I think.
So would you rather have, you know, one specific task and then just have the rest be skill and kills? At varying degrees.
Or maybe have like a third option on each of them, which is skill and kill, which is always slower than doing the other tasks. Which means that if you just play a lot, you'll get to the end as well.
That's actually a really good idea.
Because I know there's people who finish Yak Track in, what, like, first day, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they're obviously using bonds for that.
Yeah.
So. All right. Next up, construction tasks have been replaced with gain construction XP. Archaeology restoration tasks have been replaced with generic gain archaeology XP.
And so they say that,
mm-hmm.
But there is still specific excavation tasks.
Yeah, and screen soil tasks.
Yeah.
But they say restoration tasks have been replaced by
Okay. Yeah. So you're no longer... Okay.
It's no longer restore X artifacts, which, you know, was a huge climb in the past Yak Tracks. I think it was something like 40-some-odd artifacts for task 48 or 50 last time. So
gotcha. Okay. I missed that then. I thought it was all archaeology.
And that makes sense because restoring artifacts is just gaining XP.
Yes.
Now, smithing tasks have been replaced with generic gain smithing XP tasks, allowing you to smith efficiently while making progress. And it's worth
also... smelting tasks still exist.
Yes.
So this is only the ones where you make items. Again, I misread this. I thought it would be all smithing skill tasks, but it's only when you use an anvil, those tasks.
Yeah.
I didn't really mind the smithing tasks that much.
No.
I just filled my inventory with unfinished boots. And then your character would literally work their way through it automatically. It was fully AFKable. So.
Right. And now 285,000 XP in smithing for task 5.
Yeah, you can't do that anymore. Like, it's actually worse for me, I think.
Yeah. And I wonder what that would give us in terms of items on that. I haven't, you know, done smithing in a meaningful way to have an idea on this with it. But... we'll just leave that as it is. According to the calculator, if you were making, let's just say, what boots did you do before?
Oh, whatever the lowest level was, I could.
So let's just say you wanted to do, like, looking at some of these XPs on this task here, it has Eldarune Pickaxe at plus fours at 352,000 XP per hour. So, I mean, it sounds like we're going to be in for a longer run on the smithing task than we were previously.
Mm-hmm.
Which is eh, I guess, right? Because
it is for me.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe the idea behind this is that you can also smelt stuff with this, right?
Well, smelting's not bad. I mean, that's a pretty quick task, and especially with your gauntlets and everything.
Exactly.
But, yeah, this kind of smithing task doesn't... Yeah, it sounds grindier.
Let's just say you did Orichalcum boots, because, you know, that's something easily accessible. Each one of those is 350 XP. So, 814 boots for task 5, if you just did Orichalcum boots 1.
Skip. And you know how long it takes to do an inventory of boots?
Oh, yeah.
And I would skip that
one. And I mean, at least you can auto it. No, you're not going to skip that one. The alternate is 1110 fire making burns.
Oh, well. Yeah, I'm going to fire make, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I do the fire making tasks.
Yeah, I'm doing one right now.
Nia's are probably doing the same one.
Probably.
Well, I'm not doing mine right now, but I do them.
And for just a comparison's sake here, an Eldarune plate body plus 5 grants a total of 80,000 smithing XP.
But you got to get it to the 5.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Know, like... Yeah, that's 160 Eldarune bars total. And
it's a lot longer than 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah. So I think we're going to have some questions with the smithing ones going forward, having them changed like this, unless you're just, you know, going straight up smelting. But I don't know. That's just where I'm at on that one. Clue scroll ones actually do still exist. I hadn't seen any of those yet, so that's good. There's a task 7 for clue scrolls. There's Present Hunt, where you get a pair of magical jingle bells that effectively require you to find a certain number of presents throughout RuneScape. And in doing so, it's basically like the last one where we had Dragonkin lore thrown into it as well. Or Anachronia lore, rather. So that's good. Present Hunt. Divination tasks also now take into account the relic power appropriately. Apparently, it wasn't progressing properly beforehand. Batch overload recipes now advance herb lore tasks by 5 instead of 1 because you're making 5 potions. It's better when you're spending that much, right? One progress point is now awarded per segment of the Anachronia agility course, since it's so massive compared to the others. Can you believe that one lap around the Anachronia agility course was only counting as one lap?
Yeah, and it is weird. Like, the drop rates for, like, the totem and stuff are actually per segment already. So, yeah, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, that's good. Corrupted magic logs now count towards fire making tasks. Wabagongs now count towards fishing tasks. So many people I've talked to who are doing Yak Track wanted to go to their island in order to do that.
Yeah, makes sense.
And they weren't able
to. Yeah, that came up before.
Also, Wabagong oil now counts towards cooking tasks. The cremation ability now counts towards prayer tasks. What is the cremation ability?
That is burning bones, I think. So burning bones. I think it's burning bones, right?
Oh, yeah. The ability to burn bones on a bonfire or portable brazier for prayer and fire-making experience. It's a rare drop from ghosts and other ghost-like monsters. Interesting. I wonder if I have one of these.
You probably got it from the Halloween event.
And then it just becomes a passive on your character?
Yeah.
I see. I did not know we could do that.
Yeah, I think it came from the Halloween that we love, actually.
2014.
Nice. And finally, Great White Shark now count towards both fishing and cooking tasks. And I have a question with this one, and I don't know if there's a, if we can test this. Do we know if there's a task that is fishing and cooking at the same time? Because what I'm wondering is, would that, if we use the new relic, would that count for both and give double progress? Let's see, do we have a fishing or cooking task? Fishing or mining? Fishing or wood cutting? Fishing. Fishing or wood cutting? And no fishing or cooking. So there's no way of knowing which it'll progress. That's too bad. I wanted to see what would happen with that.
You would be a good QA person. Asking questions about the edge cases.
Yeah, I mean, hey, that was the first thing that cropped to my mind when we heard about this relic. And, you know, it's unfortunate we're not going to have a chance to test this here.
And all of Shane's methods are so old that only he would think to try them.
Yeah, I do play like an old fart, old school, I guess. There's also new tasks for earning marks of war.
Oh, boy. I'm going to do that whenever it comes up. It's my favorite ever.
You can go to Raksha. I'll get some of them.
I forget how many marks of war it is an hour. I think it's like 160 or 180 an hour. So this is about two and a half hours worth of PVM here to get 500 marks of war for the first task.
And that is if you don't die every second kill.
Yeah, well, you should listen to our monthly bit then about PVM and death costs that we did last month, which you can find at patreon.com/rsbnb. Very interesting discussion about that.
Nice plug.
Thank you. I don't think there's anything else about the night before Christmas to talk about, though, you know, we are approaching that time of year. I'm good on Yak Track this time around. You guys ready to move on to the next segment?
Keep it moving, Shank.
All righty. Next up, something we have been waiting for a long, long time.
Have we?
Yeah, I have. Remember, this was going to be in the initial bank rework, but they didn't get it in time?
No.
And that's the ability to search directly, search Diango directly from your bank. As long as the item can be withdrawn to the backpack. This is perfect. Because you're out there, you do a search, and you know you want to maybe search for one of your skilling masks or something. Previously, you'd have to go into the Diango interface and search there. Now the bank search automatically pulls it up, and it just works.
Yeah, that's really nice, and it is exactly like that's the perfect example, Shane. Because that's what I'm interacting with Diango the most is all the skilling outfits and stuff. Change that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it would have been nice if they could have extended this to costume room, but I can see why they didn't, because there's no search there initially. So that's fine. But, you know, just giving a quick demo on this one, you know, if you search for mask, for example, they all show up from Diango, all the potential masks you might have for doing those Slayer ones, and it's just right there, and it can be immediately withdrawn.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It really is. It really is. Also, in terms of Diango fixes this week, we have inconsistent tooltip styling has been fixed between the bank and Diango items. Also increased the size of the icons of Diango storage on mobile. I haven't actually looked at that UI before, so I don't know how bad it was. Replace the word inventory with backpack in Diango's messaging. And, you know, these things are all relatively minor. The biggest one was the search feature. The cancel search button is no longer present on Diango's search bar when there is no active search, which makes sense. And they've added new keybinds to activate search from within Diango's interface. In English and German, that key will be S. In French, that key will be R. And in Portuguese, the key is B.
Nine.
Let's see. I'm just going to do a quick test here. I wonder if there's a way to... Aha! And if you mouse over it in the actual Diango's item bank, it actually shows... what the keybind is for that. Good. As I was saying, you know, I don't know if anybody's going to realize what this is, but lo and behold, it's here. So that's good. Perfect. All right. And a new right-click / long press option has been added to the item slots in the costume room interface, which allows you to deposit or withdraw all items in a set at the same time. Woo-wee! That's another good one.
Yeah.
I feel like that these changes that were made are absolutely important for what we have. And should have been part
of the
main page.
Yeah, I've always said that, you know, like, half of RS is playing in the bank, right?
Yeah.
It's such a important part of the gameplay that it needs attention. It needs to work smoothly.
Yeah, the two biggest UIs in the game are Bank and Chat, and thankfully there have been updates to both of them this year.
Yeah.
So, let's move on to the rest of the patch notes then. There's a new Golden Reaper title for completing all boss collection logs.
Yeah, for crazy people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a hidden title with an accompanying achievement. And those who achieve this will get a global broadcast. And they say you are not required to complete the insane Fallen Angel achievement, which involves obtaining all the intricate chests from Next Angel of Death to acquire the title.
Man. That's still pretty... I mean,
that one stabs at the heart. Like,
dude. Yeah, that's insane.
I wonder how many people have the Golden Reaper title right now.
Oh, I bet we know one's going to... That'll be next on their list.
Yeah, David?
Yep.
In terms of general quality of life fixes, players will now receive login and update messages when their invention machines have finished processing their inputs, run out of secondary inputs, or run out of charges.
Oh, finally. Cool.
That one has been behaving really strange for me. So I have some logs in my plank maker right now, and this morning I was just playing along, and I got the notification. I was like, okay, that's fine. It must have finished just now. I logged in again just like a couple of hours ago, and like half an hour into my gameplay session, I got the notification, your planks are done. I'm like, again? So not entirely sure if that's working as intended. There's definitely something up there.
Yeah, there potentially is. Also, these can be toggled in the login messages or notification messages option menus.
Cool.
One concern with this, though, we've seen that you can get a huge wall of text upon login, and this doesn't add, and this adds to that problem. So, just a word of warning out there.
I almost wonder if they should just replace all the chat messages with a status report, like an actual screen.
No, yeah, that's a good idea.
But that's just another thing I need to click away.
Right, and you remember...
And one of the treasure hunter key promotions every other week.
Yeah, and you remember how much complaining there was when they brought up that main menu when you first logged in that showed what was going on, right?
Yeah.
So... Auto disassembler machines will now display the correct processing time for items disassembled in batches, such as ammunition. All right. The mechanized siphon interface has been updated to have more space and better readability, including an add, remove all, right-click, long press option, now being their own buttons. Players can now select an input box to enter how many of each siphon they'd like to store. Replace the word inventory with backpack and reduce message spam when adding or removing siphons. To account for the bait and switch relics effect, the separate deposit all options for different fish have been consolidated to one option in Deep Sea Fishing Hub and the Metaphos VIP areas and ports banks and deposit boxes. Because, of course, previously it was deposit all raw fish, now it'll just be deposit all fish. The fishing hub also has these options on the bank boat and rowboat, as well as the magical nets. Nice. And the NPC who combines jellyfish at Deep Sea Fishing has been given a name, a backstory, and a mini-map icon. It's still gross, though. Oh, that's perfect. Now, Raksha improvements, which was our big boss that we talked about last week, roided out Barney, as David called him, decreased Raksha's base damage values for attacks that scale with shadow energy. And to compensate, Raksha's shadow-infused power buff, which now scales from 0.5% to 1% per shadow energy, resulting in 100% increased damage and 100% energy up from 50%. So it's less punishing at the low end and more punishing at the high end. But the max damage remains the same. This just means that the minimum damage is now less punishing. They've also decreased the rockfall damage.
I've seen a lot of people saying that the boss is much easier now. Like, if I have to believe impressions, existing experienced PVMers can now farm this boss pretty easily because they're already used to player switching and all that stuff. But it's still pretty challenging for someone fairly new.
Yeah, and you know, David said that this puts it, you know, in the square of top end Araxor, as was initially promised with these changes that they made. So,
oh, it's probably fine then, right?
Yeah. And you know, if you want to read more about his thoughts on the boss in article format, you can find those on Informer at informer.rsbnb.com. And I'll throw a link in the show notes to this too. He put together a good article detailing all the various mechanics and whatnot as well for this. So give that a read.
You're on point with the plugs today.
Yeah, it's almost as if I planned this, right?
Yeah.
Raksha's tail chain no longer blocks player movement. People were concerned about that because it was inhibiting their work with bladed dive.
Oh, in the pools. Okay, yep.
Yeah, and there's a chain at the back that was kind of limiting, so that's what this is referring to. Enhanced fleeting, laceration, and blast diffusion boots will no longer repair into their non-upgraded forms.
Oh, man.
The boss drops an item that can upgrade the tier 80 boots into tier 90, so if you repaired them, you know, you'd be going back to tier 80. Raksha will no longer get stuck in an animation cycle if you die with a mortality active during the shadow bombardment attack cycle. And increase the base hit chance, affinity as they call it, from 45 to 55 when using melee against Raksha, which brings melee onto par with magic. So you won't get absolutely punished for using melee if that's your preferred attack style. But ranged is still the way to go because it's a magic-based boss.
Oh, that's what that clip of my Twitch stream was about. I was fighting a dinosaur in a game with melee, and it was people were surprised I was killing quote unquote Raksha with melee.
So you couldn't kill it in RuneScape, so you had to find a different game to kill it in.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough. He's actually talking about a Zelda stream that he did, for anybody wondering. Mm-hmm. And Raksha will no longer override his melee attack animation with a walk animation if the player moves out of melee range.
Nice. Yeah, that'd be confusing.
Yeah. Let's move on to the miscellaneous patches from this week. Oh, wait, there's only one of them. Players can once again choose the color of their beards and hairstyles in the appearances interface, because we've kind of jumped and bobbed throughout all the patch notes this week.
Nice.
And that was also planned as well.
Oh, Shane with the planning.
All righty. Thank you so much, everybody, for that. We're going to move on. And, you know, we just got a couple of tiny, tiny little tidbits to talk about before we move on to questions and tech news. But Jagex's 2019 financials have finally been published. And I don't think there's much to say in here, because these aren't going to be the interesting ones, because we dealt with a company sale this year. And the really interesting ones are going to be the 2020 ones to see how the sales reported. So we'll probably get those at some point next year. But, you know, I think the thing that we got to take away from the 2019 report is that RuneScape 3 revenue remained constant. It actually went down slightly because of the tapering off of microtransactions, which they admit in the report here was done to garner player sentiment.
I mean, I think it's wise, right? I think maximizing profit right now by just pushing microtransactions down players' throats is very short-sighted.
Yep.
So, yeah, very nice.
Yeah, and, you know, what I have to say with this is that, you know, you have yet again a revenue of 110 million pounds and a net profit of 46 million pounds. The staffing increased from 337 to 377 employees. And, you know, the thing to take away from this at the end of the year, if you're a RuneScape 3 player and you didn't like microtransactions, is that you've won. Jagex has heard you in that microtransactions have been tapered back.
Yes.
To a point where revenues have gone down a bit.
Me closing the Treasure Hunter pop-up button every day has worked. Me destroying all my Treasure Hunter keys has worked. Victory! Woo!
But I don't think those ones are counted because they're not purchased.
Okay.
But you can call it a victory if you'd like.
I don't want to give them hope. Because they will stop at nothing short of no microtransaction ever. And
I am totally okay with microtransactions to some extent, but if a game like RuneScape, where the primary gameplay is progression and the microtransactions let you buy progression, that just breaks the game. So those microtransactions need to go. But I'm completely fine with cosmetics.
I think Tannis wants to have a word with you about oddments. But perhaps not this episode.
Yeah.
Well, I just have a different view. Like, I think that's why I think bonus is acceptable and blamps aren't. So that's my distinction. Because you're not cutting content out. You're making it convenient.
You're making the content shorter. You go to it twice as fast. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I personally, like you, Sirion, don't have much of a problem with microtransactions. It depends on their format. But I will say out there to our listeners who do have concerns with microtransactions, and we heard this in our last round table, is that it actually feels better this year than it did in the past. But I'll just say this to everybody out there. You know, treat this as a victory and think of where you want to go further from this. I don't think the next logical step, if I would be an anti-microtransaction person, would be for the lobbying of all removal of microtransaction. I'd lobby for further evolution of it, and, you know, I'd take it in a gradual way. And I don't know that there's anybody out there who's actually leading that charge in a clear and concise way.
No. It's... Ah! That's what I hear.
Right. And, you know, I think it'd be interesting to have a discussion on that. I might actually write my Informer article this month on this and put myself in that mode and say what a strategy would be. But Just a couple of other little tidbits here. They paused publishing because of the potential of sale in 2020. And they say that when it comes to R&D spending on and investments on new games, we are proud that these achievements have come even in the face of corporate headwinds caused by the parent company's challenges in China and potentially potential company sale.
Wait, they are pausing publishing?
Yeah, well, I mean, not pausing it entirely, but that's why we didn't see any games published this year, is because of the sale.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting, because I felt that was their big next move, right?
It was going to
become a publisher.
Yeah.
And then they dropped it almost immediately again. Interesting.
And I'm saving the biggest for last. Old School RuneScape brought in £65 million revenue. In 2018, £45 million revenue. And for the first time, brings in more revenue than RuneScape 3. Without microtransactions.
There's the other.
I told you I was saving it.
Now, we're never going to hear the end of it now. Man.
There's actually a really convincing persuasive ploy to be made with this, but nobody has made it yet that I see.
We're never going to.
And I don't want to. I need to form it a little bit in my head, but it involves looking at what we've done in RuneScape 3 so far with the microtransaction state and what Old School's been able to accomplish. So I'll just leave it at that. But I think the Informer article is definitely going to be on this. Very good.
I think it also shows the power of making a streamable game, right?
Yeah.
People are very prone to imitation, right? Like, look at the big successes of this year, right? Fall Guys, Among Us, those are the games that become big because they are incredibly streamable. So, arguably, RS, like, Old School is much more, like, I can't put my finger on why, like, don't ask me why.
That's the thing. Yeah, why?
Like, Old School is the streamable game here. RuneScape 3 isn't. So, and I think that's why that game is being played so much more.
Which I can't figure out because, honestly, I find Old School streams just boring gameplay. Like, it's just the same old grind. I've never been able to figure that out. I have to wonder if it's just personalities that are driving it. I don't know.
It's the personalities. And I actually have to talk to you guys about this after. You guys are kind of tangentially touching on something that I've noticed, but it's not related to financials or anything podcast related. It's just related to what you guys mentioned, and it's an important observation to make. But
I mean, yeah, like it's the personalities, and the personalities have picked up Old School. So, you know, I think as a developer, publisher, whatever, it's important to lean into that, and Old School was doing it well. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's paying off.
And Leagues is a good example of that.
Well, even Iron Man started as a streamer, right? Or was a YouTuber. I mean, still, they started that on their own before Jagex picked it up.
Yeah.
It was streamable. So,
I think there's lots of lessons to be learned here. But
yeah.
In any case, we're going to move on. But everybody who logs in this week will have got an invite to the RuneScape 20th anniversary party, which kicks off on January 4th. And, you know, they say there's going to be a big to-do when that arrives. And, you know, we don't know exactly what it's going to entail. But the groundwork is already being laid for that.
50 mil for everybody that shows up.
Well, if that was to happen, you'd need a RuneScape Oprah.
You get 50 mil, and you get 50 mil. Yeah.
Also, as of December 15th, you can claim new Prime Gaming goods, and this time you get 2 Umbral chests and a Yak Track care package, which they say contains an assortment of useful items that'll help you along with the Yak Track.
So I just claimed mine. I can tell you exactly what's in the care package. 5 medium smoldering lamps, 5 track skip tokens, and 5,000 oddments.
Oh, I'm on that. That's a Twitch Prime?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Gimme.
Perfect.
What you can also get on Twitch Prime, by the way, is early access to Soul Wars in old school RuneScape.
Oh. That's interesting.
Yeah, even I got an email about that.
Really?
Yeah.
And I will live present you with my spoils from the Umbral chest as
well.
Oh,
please
don't. Oh, 25 mil. Boom!
For real?
Yeah.
Holy shit, I'm definitely grabbing. Oh, if I get crap, I'm going to be so mad.
I've gotten only lucky
items. Am I the only one who
so
doesn't
far,
have Amazon
so...
Prime?
Probably.
A lucky armadillo helmet. I am so delighted.
I got a perfect gif for you with that.
How many oddments will that get you?
There's the gif. Yeah.
It's a gif?
Oh, not oh, this right. debate. Anyways, we're gonna wrap this up now. January 1st, Premier Club members will get a variety pack filled with useful items, 2 pulse cores, and their monthly 1,000 oddments, and there will be a New Year sale starting on January 1st. And yes, this is the news post, the last news post of the year. Okay, now that's Jagex's promotion done. And, you know, we love this game, and that's why we do that. But we also, of course, have to thank our wonderful Patreon supporters for making this episode possible, because, you know, without you guys, we wouldn't get to do all the fun stuff that we do around here. So this week, I'd like to thank Alvaro L., Andrew C., Arvidzel, a returning subscriber, Brock H., Cameron, Christian S., Cook Me Plocks, Diana, Duramax, Jade Gizmo, Jade W., Jason S., Joe M., John P., Keski, Kyle, Lucky Ducky, Nora, Rastafa, Ricky A., Samantha R., Soupfinder, Stobbeve, The Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V., and Zant. Thank you all of you for your support. It truly does mean the world to us. And if you want to know what this is about, just head on over to patreon.com/rsvnb, and there you can learn about our offerings. For as little as $1 a month, you gain access to the entire back catalog of monthly bits that includes episodes like the PVM Economics and Death Costs episode that went live 2 weeks ago, as well as hits like our focus on old school RuneScape, the Legends of RSBNB update, and so much more from this year. We also do have a $3 a month tier where you get a special rank on Discord and a mention on the podcast at the start of the month, in addition to high-quality stereo versions of the podcast. And for $5 a month, you'll receive a shout-out each and every week and exclusive access to the outtakes that we use to form the clip show, which is coming very, very soon. That episode will release at the end of the year, and that's our $5 a month tier. And, of course, every month we do our monthly bit. We do our inside update, which is a fun little interview with one of the hosts or production team members about something that we do here at the podcast. We also have the round table, which is happening this Saturday. This one's going to be a bit of a different one since it's the last one of the year. We're actually doing a flying round table. We're still going to have the discussion about RuneScape and everything, but we're going to be doing it from up in the air. We're going to be flying around in Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Yeah.
I've already
found... So you better get your download started on your Game Pass.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That is true.
And I'll try and get this out before that happens, just so people can hear it. But yeah, it's a huge download. We'll be taking about an hour, 20-minute flight. We'll be flying from Edmonton to Vancouver. And that should be a fun one. I don't know if you've ever flown over the Rockies yet, Sirion, have you?
I have not. It has been on my to-do list, but I have not actually done a flight.
Yeah, we might just go with clear weather, because it's a, because we want to see stuff other than just clouds. I did a test flight yesterday on this just to, you know, make sure it would fit all within the time. And, oh boy, it was one of the bumpiest ones I'd ever had.
Really?
Yeah, I had a 60-knot crosswind up at 36,000 feet, and the plane was shaking a lot.
Oh, so you're using one of the big boys, huh?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But, of course, we also have movie night, which we posted the readback of on Patreon of our Fury movie night. And should we reach $200 a month at some point in the future, we'll launch a line of merchandise, including T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and potentially other things as well. But, of course, what everybody really wants is that Hot Ones experience where Tanis and myself and somebody else who I haven't been able to rope in yet.
Not everybody.
I said Tanis and myself.
No, I know, but you said everyone looking forward to. No, no, not everybody's looking forward to it.
I haven't been able to rope anyone in. Everybody says they don't do spice.
Well, neither do I, but here we are.
Okay, Sirion, that means you're in then.
No! No!
Hey, we'll let you bring some mayonnaise too while you're at it.
No.
Helps you take the edge off. I know you Brits like your mayonnaise.
I don't like mayonnaise.
Oh, that must be the Dutch.
I hate spices too. Oh boy.
All right, if you guys want to learn more about this, patreon.com/RSBNB. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
All right, question from Thieves, and this is something that he says just popped into his head and set off his theory sensors, and he wants our thoughts on it. He says, in August, we got the portable workbench, treasure hunter item. In October, we got the artificer's measure, which is untrainable and requires 99 crafting and 102 archaeology. And some of the ingredients for this item require prif. Therefore, it's about a minimum of 75 construction to create this item, too. And in November, we got construction contracts with the new construction outfit and the plank box. Now, if a player were to complete the estate agent's store, they would accrue about 5 million XP. This month, we also got a new yak track that awards extra construction XP throughout its duration, as well as archaeology and herb lore. This isn't outside the norm of a yak track, but it's just interesting that construction has been included this time. Before herb lore and farming were boosted to 120, there was a news post that stated we will be increasing more skills to 120, and we are currently working on two skills in particular, which turned out to be farming and herb lore. We will be making 120s full with worthwhile stuff to unlock, and we want to reassure you that we won't be releasing 120s at an accelerated pace. Now, surprisingly, the last few months have been fairly construction-heavy, notably with the artificer's measure and the outfit tailored for extremely high-level players. Construction sits at 24 out of the 28 skills that players have maxed in due to the fact it's expensive, boring, intensive, and sadly useless. So here's the question. The construction updates I've listed tackle some of the problems I mentioned above. Contracts and the artificer's measure made it less expensive. The outfit, portable, and plank box have made it less intensive, and the skill sadly remains boring and useless. However, have we already seen the construction rework, or are Jagex giving us some early tools and boosts in preparation for 120 construction or rework, like I suspect? I would appreciate the feedback.
Who wants to do it? Anyone else? Anyone else got a pen?
I thought you did.
I do.
Okay, go for it.
Well, sadly, I think the answer is like no and no and no. I don't think this is enough. And I don't think they're doing it. I don't think it's in the near future. And I would hope that they would have the foresight to not push this to 120 without having a legitimate rework. Because Thieves makes a great point with the uselessness of the skill. And that pains me because I love it. It's one of my favorite skills, but it doesn't have the same use that it once did. And that has to be addressed before you can push that to 120.
Well, you could push it out to 120 and address the usefulness all in one shot.
With the rework?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm of two opinions on this. I don't think if the term construction rework is to imply player-owned house rework, I don't think we'll see that in 2021. Could we potentially, at the tail end of 21, see a 120 construction that isn't tied to the POH? I think it's a possibility. But I wouldn't count on a POH rework. Because before archaeology, the construction skill with the POH was the biggest update that they ever put out. And back then, it took them 18 months back in 2006 with a 2006 development budget and cycle. Now extrapolate that out to 2020 and you can see how long it would take something like that. And let alone, I think there'd be huge challenges with redoing the POH.
But anything less than a redone POH is not going to the player base is not going to accept that as a construction rework. It's the same thing as when you think of the bank rework, right? What did I say all along? What was the symbol of that?
Placeholders.
And it's the same thing with construction. If you don't touch the POH, people will not consider it a rework.
All right, now I'm waiting for Sirion to tell us why we're wrong.
I know, right? Me too.
Oh, no, actually not today. I'm actually sort of on Tana's side here. I think, yeah, the usefulness of the skill just needs to be addressed. And I think the easiest way is to do that is to take construction outside of the player-owned houses like we got with the contracts, but build actual good content there and then tie that into a 120. I don't really have anything sophisticated this time for you guys.
Right. And and with that, you still have the problem that the POH is left behind.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those things that, yeah, you need to rebuild it from scratch to get any use out of it. You're sort of stuck with the spaghetti there. And
in 2006, there were bugs with it.
The question, I think, this might be a question for you guys. What do you think? If they're going to put all this effort into basically rebuilding player-owned houses from scratch, right? That's a lot of work.
It's basically redoing the skill.
It's basically redoing the skill. Would you rather have that or something completely else, completely new? How attached are we actually to player-owned houses?
Something else.
See, I would rather have the house, but I mean, you got to think every MMO out there has a house kind of building construction.
Stow doesn't.
Thing. Stow doesn't?
No. Hmm. Well, there's the Fleet Starbase, but that's a clan project, right?
Right. But, you have houses in ESO, Fallout, all that. Even, I think it's...
There's also the argument to be made that old school has POH changes that people want.
Yeah.
In particular, they have those hidey hole kind of things. They also have the greenhouse, which we didn't get. And no, we're not going to, talk about that, but...
What do we get instead, Shay?
The aquarium.
Super useful, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. It still hurts, don't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I don't know. I honestly think that if you're going to rework construction, you just got to do a quality of life pass to the POH beforehand and then come in with 120 with a new training method in particular. Something that reinvents it in the way that archaeology was a from the ground up whole base game design or the way the mining and smithing was.
Yeah, it needs to be that level. And I mean, and that ends up being the decision. Do you tie up the resources for that.
You also have to remember that when the POH and construction came out, it was the money sink skill. So you have to think, do you want 99 to 120 with the new methods to also be a money sink?
Why is all the money sink on the skilling side?
Come on. No.
No, I know, I know. Death's office. We did the dev cost, I know. But, yeah.
I don't know. It's a hard question. Sirion, which one would you want? You asked that question. Which would you rather have, you know, the POH or something else?
I'm not too attached to the very idea of the POH in itself. I just want it to be useful, and if we can't make it useful with the POH, then it needs to be replaced with something else. Like, I think we had this discussion for agility. Like,
yep.
Little teaser here in what we discussed on that on that bit, where we talked about shortcuts, right?
Yep.
That they don't make sense in agility, and I'm not too attached to keeping them in agility. So let's make a different system for that, and come up with something else to make agility useful. Like, I think it's important to keep the identity of a skill. Like, you could argue that the POH and designing your own house and place could be considered the identity of the skill. But it's building your own house is almost sort of a side gig.
Yeah, it feels kind of boring in 2020. Whereas I think the reason everybody liked it in 2006 was because we didn't have any player gathering spots back then, and this was something that had been promised since Classic.
Well, yeah, exactly. It was also like a place I would have liked to seen it as a player, like skilling place where you could do these different things, you know. And we have that with the altar, you know, and I guess the armor stand is still useful. But I think we could have really went down that road and made the house a convenience kind of thing that I don't know. When things are like OP, I want it to be on the player side, not like necessarily a location side. So like think about it. If you could have had some rooms or some functionality in the POH, that would have, you know, that you find in Prif, but wouldn't have necessarily had to be there because we would have already, you know, had access to it at a house. You could have toned that down, and I think everyone would have been a little happy about that.
Yeah, and you know, I think just to wrap this up, we can answer the last bit of Thieves' question. Have we already seen the construction rework?
No,
I don't think so. And I think what has been detailed that's come out over the last few months is just common sense quality of life changes that you need to make to most of the skills in the game. And, you know, there might have been a different area where we could have called that a rework, but I think our perspective after mining and smithing and even after archaeology has changed as to what RuneScape is capable of. And I think that's why we haven't seen the rework yet.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect
thing. And they don't want to touch construction, dude. They don't.
No, they don't.
Like, we do, they don't.
Yeah, and I mean, you just have to go back to remember the era of when this was built and how long it took to build. In that, you know, in 2006, it took 18 months to build a skill, and it was the most complex thing at the entire time. And there's a reason it hasn't been touched since then. It's because the amount of investment that would be required to go in to re-engineer the way the POH works, to bring it up to modern standards, like you said, Sirion, is probably worth it to put something else out instead.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think you. Yeah. If you're going to do it, you got to rip it out and start over.
Yeah. It's like one of those home makeover shows. You know, you're not just, you know, changing a room here and there. You're completely gutting the house and starting fresh from the frame.
Yeah.
So. Alrighty, thank you, Thieves, for that question. Moving on into tech news, you know. Normally, some weeks we don't have much to say when it comes to tech news, but this week was a huge, huge week. First and foremost, many, many big Fortune 500 companies, actually more than 425 of them, were hacked, as well as the U.S. Treasury and Commerce Departments, as well as all five branches of the U.S. military, all 10 of the top 10 U.S. telecommunication companies. What the heck was that?
Sorry. That was a phone that should not have rang because I had my Bluetooth on, so that wouldn't happen.
Huh. All right.
The diet. Sorry.
As well as the Pentagon, State Department, NASA, NSA, the Postal Service, NOAA, which handles weather, the Department of Justice, and the Office of the President of the United States. Yeah, we're still waiting to see how big this is, but this is potentially one of the biggest breaches that we have seen on the cybersecurity front in a long time. And this is all due to what's called a supply chain attack by way of SolarWinds Software, which is a security vendor that was supposed to be helping these companies and government agencies manage their IT systems.
The irony is pretty ironic.
Yeah.
Now, do they get held accountable, maybe, for this? You know?
I don't know.
You're like a security company and kind of like let everything get hacked, right?
Microsoft was on this list, notably as well. Amazon, Apple, and Google were not, nor was Facebook. But
they probably have in-house security, right?
Probably, but you know, with this, the initial story is pointing it to be the Russians.
Oh, always
no,
the Russians.
Not Pooty Poo. No.
Oh, those Russians.
Buddy.
Yeah, and you know, I think any story that within the first, you know, 8 hours of this coming out points to Russia needs to have a hard look put onto it. And, you know, we need to, of course, go through the full path of investigation to realize what actually happened here. But according to a Reuters story, hackers believed to be working for Russia were apparently monitoring internal email traffic from the U.S. Treasury and Commerce Departments.
They didn't even have to hack. I mean, couldn't they just picked up the phone?
No, there's no collusion. Also, with this, you of course have the Department of Homeland Security saying that they're issuing an emergency directive ordering all federal agencies to immediately disconnect the affected Orion products from their network. So does that mean, like, disconnect the cord?
Yeah, unplug. What a worthless agency that is. Just the worst.
But it gets better. It gets better. Microsoft issued their own post on this. You know what their post says? Their post says that the attackers were able to add malicious code to software updates provided by SolarWinds for these Orion users. This resulted in the attacker gaining a foothold in the network where the attacker can gain elevated credentials, which means, put simply, that all bets are off with this.
Not the Space Force.
They say from here, the attackers could have forged single sign-on tokens to impersonate any existing user or account, including highly privileged accounts. And then they could have used those high privilege accounts to add their own accounts that people might not have realized, enabling them to call APIs or application programming interfaces with the permissions assigned to those applications. And they say this code could have gone undetected. The code added to the Orion software update could have gone undetected by antivirus software programs and other security tools, thanks to guidance from SolarWinds itself. Because in a support advisory, they say that its products may not work properly unless their file directories are exempted from antivirus scans and group policy restrictions.
Username, okay. McDonald's password cheeseburger. Okay.
But, you know, the important thing to note on this is that I'm adding in that I think any report that pushes blame within 24 hours should be rightfully viewed with skepticism. But it also says that it's unclear how many of the customers listed on the SolarWinds websites are actually users of this software. But nobody is at this point is speaking as to who might have been compromised with this, except for the people that were already told to unplug it.
I mean, given like you said, all bets are off, it's probably kind of wise until we know the full impact.
That's kind of what you call a BFD, right? And we're just going to probably, I mean, we'll probably let them off the hook just like we did.
And from what I can tell, this is not gaining much coverage in the mainstream media in the U.S.
No. I have not heard it, not even on progressive news. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it just proves what a media echo chamber there is. But, I mean, sure. I don't think any of our listeners are going to be affected by this, unless you're, you know, an IT person at one of these companies.
Well, yeah, but we cannot let companies keep getting away with these kinds of...
Well, but sometimes the thing is that when you're dealing with a huge organization, and the hallmark for this was the Sony hack a number of years ago. I forget how many Decembers ago that was, but that Sony hack, for a person or people to be responsible for the cybersecurity of an organization as big as Sony or any of these other three or any of these other companies listed here, you know, these kind of things ultimately do happen. There needs to be, of course, a wider look up at the SolarWinds side to see if there was any greater negligence.
These kinds of things, you know what? This brings up a better point.
They can happen.
Maybe this shit shouldn't be farmed out to a third party when it comes to that kind of stuff. Just saying. I mean, we're talking about the branches of the military, right?
Cases of the branches of the military, yes, I will agree with you. But I think for any other Fortune 500 company, it's entirely reasonable for them to expect that they would, you know, purchase security solutions.
Yeah, no, that's fine. But I mean, the military, man.
I mean, the problem with security is, right? Like
you're going to say what I was going to say next. Go ahead.
Yeah, like, don't run your own cybersecurity is the main advisory. Like,
yeah.
Security is so important that it's something you want to have built and maintained by experts in cybersecurity.
Exactly.
It's a hugely complex topic. Ideally, you want the implementation of your security to be public, completely public. And this might sound very counterintuitive, but there is this principle, I think it's called Kirchhoff's principle, that says if your security relies on obscurity of the algorithm, it's not secure.
Yep.
And this is what you see in things like OpenSSL, right? Like, on a day-to-day basis, your network traffic is being encrypted by algorithms that everybody knows. The only thing that people don't know about that traffic is the key. And it is mathematically proven that that algorithm is secure as long as the key is secure. So, just saying, like, write your own security, you know, writing any kind of software comes with bugs. And when it comes to security, a small, tiny bug can have very far-reaching consequences.
Yeah.
So,
and with security,
going with a trusted vendor can actually work better.
Yeah, and there's no way to, you know, like you said, unless it's an algorithm or a hashing algorithm or an encryption algorithm, you can prove that those are secure mathematically. But if you have a software solution, you can't prove that that's safe. You don't know if bugs are going to turn up in that. The only way you're going to know is if it's open source and you have lots of eyes on it and time persists where it's proven secure over time.
Yeah, that's sort of the thing. It's actually a massive field of research right now. It is not currently possible to prove that a piece of code is correct. Like, we can design an algorithm An algorithm is just a set of logical and mathematical steps, right? It is just saying, do this, do this, do this. But it's an oversimplification of actually implementing all this stuff in code. And that implementation step is where things go wrong.
Precisely. Precisely.
Because that's when we lose the mathematical correctness, because it is one of many ways to represent that in code.
I think that's a perfect place to move on to the next story, because there was also some other concerns going on this week. In particular, several Google applications, including YouTube, Gmail, Drive, and Google Docs, had a severe outage on Tuesday. Started before noon UK time, lasted more than a half an hour. It also persisted out to the Android Play Store, Google Maps, and pretty much any other service that required a login. And Google says that it was down for about 45 minutes from 3:47 a.m. Pacific time due to an internal storage quota issue. And my first thought at this point was, oh, this is related to solar winds. But perhaps not. I'm 95% inclined to believe what Google has to say on the matter with this one here for this. But this affected you. It affected anyone trying to watch YouTube. It affected anyone trying to do anything but search, really.
And, or watch YouTube in incognito mode. That worked as well, apparently.
Yes, that did work. It also knocked off Google Home devices, including Nest speakers, Google Assistants, and the security cameras. Yeah.
Bummer.
And there's a fun little tweet that's in this BBC article here, and I saw this one floating around on the internet. A guy by the name of Joe Brown, very, very common name, says, I'm sitting here in the dark in my toddler's room because the light is controlled by Google Home. Rethinking a lot right now.
Yeah, it goes to show how our reliance on technology is, well, very brittle. And it goes to say what Tanner says, right? Like, imagine that the military ran on Google Maps to figure out where to shoot the next rocket. Like, I'm on purpose choosing a bit of an exaggerated example, but
yeah,
there might be a hospital running, like, trying to send like amounts of medicine, like medicine dosages, along using Gmail. If that Gmail goes down and it's like a life-threatening situation, you better have a backup in place. So, I think the comment there that said "are we thinking a lot right now" is very spot on. And I know it was delivered as a joke, and it's just the light in their toddler's room, but. I think there will be many companies scratching themselves behind their ears right now and be like, okay, we should probably think about what actually happens if Google goes down.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, there's also a Jagex. Was this the same day that some of the servers were out,
yes,
too? I wonder, yes, if that was related.
It was before, I think. It started before.
Okay. Because,
Maybe they caused a problem at Google.
Because people couldn't play Pokemon Go as well during this time because of the
that
Google
That uses
outage.
The Google Maps API, doesn't it?
Ah, okay, there you go.
Yeah. Discord had some trouble too with file uploads.
What?
Yeah, because Discord runs on Google Cloud, so.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. All right. I thought Discord was AWS.
Nope, Google Cloud.
Fascinating. AWS is Amazon Web Services, just for clarification. But
and on the third big one, PopQuiz, third big one?
Azure, Microsoft.
Excellent. You passed with flying colors.
Yeah, because that's the one I use for some of our other stuff. Yeah. But Anyways, we got another story. This one's from you, out of the EU. More talk on security and encryption.
It's not like I'm in the EU anymore.
True.
Well, for another 14 days.
Nope. The UK is outside of the EU.
Right, that's just the trade deal that's collapsing, right? Yes. But anyways, the EU wants, you know, to get their fingers in encryption for the internet.
I love how they came up with this great catchphrase, which is security to encryption and security despite encryption. It is the perfect summary of the literally impossible. Honestly, I don't know what to say. It's just the idiocy continues.
Effectively,
well, we just talked about encryption, right?
Yeah,
and
we
how,
did.
How Kirchhoff's principle says your algorithm should be secure, even if you know the exact implementation details of it.
Yep.
Right? The only thing that keeps it hidden is the key. Now, what the government wants security to be is they want to be able to be... They basically say, we really care about end-to-end encryption. Privacy is super important, and all communication between people should be encrypted.
Therefore, it should be the kind of encryption we have just talked about, right?
Yes. Also, we want to read it.
Yeah, we need the key, though. We're gonna have to ask for your key.
So that there's like, how do I say this?
You know
this?
What the potential solution is for this? You know, people always talk about WhatsApp and whatnot being end-to-end secure. iMessage is end-to-end and secure, but your keys for that are stored on Apple servers.
Yes. The thing is that really end-to-end secure at that point?
No, it's not.
At that point?
It's like, secure against casual peepers along the line.
And this is sort of the thing, right? Like, I understand the arguments from the government. But what we're looking here is a mathematical impossibility.
Yeah. And
you cannot mathematically determine who can see the contents of your message and who can't. You can't have like a mathematical formula that has the word government in there and it all figures itself out. That's just not how it works.
Yeah, it's like you're not half pregnant, right? You're either you're in or you're not.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And let's say that we go with a solution like Apple's, where the key is still stored centrally. So if a government really wants to, they can go to Apple. Apple can give the key, and you get access. Well, if you know that that's a thing, then you, as a criminal who are planning some kind of crime, like maybe you want to steal lollipops from the corner shop, and you don't want the police to know about that, you would just switch to a different chat app that doesn't do that.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. I just told you don't run your own encryption, but you totally can. Because there are formulas out there.
There's open source ways of doing it. You know, one of my favorite open source projects is GPG.
Right.
GNU PGP, like, rather.
I could step on a plane right now, right, to you in Edmonton, mm-hmm. hand you a piece of paper with the key,
mm-hmm.
and go back home, and we could communicate with each other, and it would be uncrackable unless you have a really insanely strong computer cracking that communication.
Yeah.
And we can just pick the key so big that no hardware that will exist in the next 10 to 20 years will crack it.
Or even more. Look, we got a perfect example just this week of what you're talking about, Sirion. Did you heard like the Zodiac Killer's cipher?
Oh, that was wonderful.
Finally, after all these years, because they didn't have the key. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Yes. Except for this happens on computers, and the numbers are like like hundreds of digits long, right? So yeah. it's a massive problem, and we can do that. So if Shane and I decided we want to do a coup and become president in the US without anybody knowing about it, I just spoiled up another podcast, okay. But you know, we can, right? There are totally ways for us to communicate. We could communicate over plain text mail and just encrypt the messages locally.
But you can't, but we can't use Gmail for that. We'd have to use our own email server. But even that's trivial to set up. You know, a $5 Linode and you're done.
We could use Gmail. It's fine, right? Who cares? We have the key on our site. We encrypt it locally and put the encrypted message in Gmail and I send it over.
Enough. Right. Nobody knows about PGP email.
I could send the encoded thing in an envelope with big letters on it that says secrets inside, please open. And like that's the whole thing about encryption. So the government may push these big companies to compromise on encryption, right? And it's not going to stop any criminal. They could make it illegal, right, to send encrypted messages.
And then the path that that goes is then you outlaw Microsoft, Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon from implementing encryption on their end. And then the next step forward is you prevent software hosters like GitHub and the like from hosting encryption, and then you prevent, you know, pretty much any software aggregator from hosting it as well. And then, you know, it just keeps trickling down to a point where, you know, it's going to be hosted in an open source repository somewhere on the internet, and someone's going to find it.
That's the thing, right? Like, I mean, I'm not saying we should, like, they will ban encryption altogether, but they will ban encryption where the key is not stored centrally. Where this key is not accessible by the government, right? They will mandate that the government always gets the key to all encryption. Who bloody cares? I can still, like, a criminal is not going to abide by the law. Isn't that the very definition of the word criminal?
And this is an example of feel-good policy that is, you know, quite clearly made by people who don't understand anything about this field. And, you know, in terms of doing that, you're setting yourself up for failure, and you know, we just need to.
Look at how it turned out. How the forbidding illegal downloads turned out. You can still find ways to get.
Yeah, they're even easier than you can get them before.
Yeah, like people will find a way.
Magnet links are wonderful.
Like in most European countries, like. The Pirate Bay is blocked, but you Google it and you get a list of like 100 proxies that you can use to get to the Pirate Bay. So, you know, it's not going to, like, people will find ways, and I think this is a completely different angle, and I accept that this is a hard problem. I don't have the solutions either, but the science doesn't lie. This isn't one. Of them.
Yeah. All right. I think that covers that story. And, you know, with that, I think we can move on to wrap this one up. And, you know, just keep your eyes open for this kind of thing that, you know, it's not all black and white. And it's a lot more complicated than people in the media and people in government are leading on to be. As we move on and wrap this up, we had our Slayer Skill of the Month. We had Frogger Man win again with 6.5 million XP gained. And just recently, our archaeology contest, or sorry, our smithing contest is gone, has run as well. So it should be fun.
Nice.
All right. What do we got for achievements?
We have Thieves getting 120 fire making on December 15. And also on December 15, we get Xandan Gum getting 99 archaeology.
Nicely done.
Okay, let's see. Then we have the Black Nexican with 120 archaeology on December 13th. And we have Silly Cat 98 with 99 fire making on the 12th.
Nicely done. And then We have Failure to Comply with 99 Ranged on December 10th, Rolladude 540 with 99 Archaeology also on the 10th, and Thieves got 120 Cooking on December 10th. Obviously on a 120 bench there he is.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Pick of the week time. I got one for you guys this week.
Okay.
So
Do tell.
Have you guys ever been in a situation where you're trying to figure out what exactly a friend's Macintosh had, or maybe it's one of your old Macintosh computers or an iPod or an iPhone, and you're trying to figure out exactly what the specs of that is, or maybe you just need a little bit more information about that Apple product?
Yeah, I did that with an Apple TV to try to figure out if I could use a controller with it.
Right. And
this
there's
week, actually.
And there's actually a good website that handles this. I don't know if they do Apple TVs, but they do every other main device out there. And it's called everymac.com. And I've been waiting to do this one. You can search by series, by year, by processor, by case. So if you want to go back and you want to see all the iMacs, you can do that. As well, and you know, it gives you all the details of every Mac going back to let's just click on the MacBook Pro, and that one starts in 2006. But if you want to go back even further, you can click on the iMac, and they have iMac information going back all the way to the 1999 iMac G3, the green one. And you get this entire page of Mac stats and information here. So if we go to mine right now, the 27 inch 3.4 i5, it's got all of the stats on it, and I mean everything is on here that you could want. And I mean, you can even go back. If we go back to the MacBook Pro list, one of my first Max was the 2010 2.4 gigahertz Core 2 Duo. And it's right there. All the stats are right there for that Macintosh. And you can go back even further. And, you know, the screen quit on this one. It was out of warranty. Before that, I had a Core 2 Duo 15-inch 2.16 gigahertz MacBook Pro, and you can literally go back and see all the stats on these. This was introduced in October 2006. Two cores on the processor, DDR 667 megahertz RAM came with 512 megs of it. Or sorry, 1 gigabyte max RAM, 4 gigabytes, with a Radeon X1600 with 128 megs of VRAM. But every Apple product, it's all detailed here. Macs, iPods, iPads, everything that you could ever want a statistic on, you can find it on this website, everymac.com. And I don't think they have Apple TVs, Tannis, so this wouldn't have helped you. But if you want to go back to the iPhones, you can find that as well. And I don't know. I just have fun browsing this website, seeing, you know, all the Macs that I had in the past that have gone on to become decommissioned and the like. So good fun. Everymac.com. And I actually started using this website this summer when I was having... Oh, no, they do have Apple TVs. They do have Apple TVs. I missed that.
Oh, cool.
But I started using this summer when I was looking to see if I could repair my headphone jack on my own. But the information here said, you know, you're probably under warranty, so we should, you know, go and do it at the Apple store kind of thing. But that's when I started using this website. And if you do anything with Apple products, this is one you're going to want to bookmark, everymac.com. Ciaran, were you able to find yours on there?
I haven't checked.
Okay. I know it's so fun looking back at those old ones. So, but fun fact, the old Apple TV first generation did not have HDMI output on it. Just had a component video. So, and had a standard hard drive in it, too. That was before streaming became a thing. But that's the pick of the week, everymac.com. All right. Cool. What have we been up to? Let's start with you, Tannis.
Yak tracking. and archaeology.
Okay, fair enough. Sirion, unless you want to elaborate on that.
Yeah, and I haven't been playing much lately. It's just, yeah, the drive to log in every day is not there anymore. So I don't. It's kind of nice to be able to admit that to yourself, at least. So
I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean, like we said in the past, that, you know, you don't like RuneScape. It's just that, you know, hey, I've done what I need to do for now, and, you know, when it's time to move on to the next section, we'll do that. And, you know, I think that's a perfectly fine way to play RS too. And I think we're going to get there too with mobile, that we're going to, you know, get to a point where, you know, 20 to 30 minutes could be a good enough play session for everybody in a day, right?
Yeah, like, even that, you know, I only did the Violet is Blue 2 quest today, earlier today, because it was the first time I actually logged in since it was released. So, you know, yeah, I'm taking it a bit easy. I'm still doing a bunch of archaeology, just slowly making my way. I finished Everlight, which is very nice. So I'm now working my way to a level 107, so I can finish Warforge and Caradat. And yeah, I've been busy on the clan quest side. We're running an advent calendar.
Which you might have heard about if you read the community section of the RuneScape news post today or this week.
Yeah, we were mentioned there. I definitely recommend checking it out. There's a lot of stuff.
That's a benefit Sunday, we provide to non-members as well, right?
Yes, it's completely public. Last Saturday, I did a live stream. You can probably still find it again if you want to see my face and see me being owned by the game, because I'm not very good at playing video games. I had a lot of fun, but there's lots of stuff there for everyone. So I've been really busy managing that. And, you know, we have some great contributors in the clan and all working together, but it does take a lot of effort just getting it all together and keeping everything on schedule. So that's been most of my work.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful web design you have there on the wiki.
Yes, for something that we came up with the idea pretty late, so it's all pretty scrappy on the backside, but I think we're delivering something nice there.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And as for me this week on RS, you know, I've of course done Violet is Blue. I've also been still, you know, I just can't pull myself away from archaeology. I don't know why. I'm going to focus on Yak Track as we get closer to Christmas, I believe. But you'll recall last week I talked about the Spear of Annihilation. Well, I was doing some archaeology again today, and I got another spear tip drop.
And you were mad about my 25 mil from an umbral chest. You cannot complain.
Right.
So that's it. That's in effect two tier 92 weapons in 2 weeks, guys.
Wow.
If I were to take up the masterwork.
Damn.
That thing has a 150,000 drop rate.
Well, you've always been the lucky one.
I don't know what the hell's going on with that, but okay.
It happens. It happens. That's also all your drops for 2021 taking
care
of.
Oh, let's not say that.
Oh, I am saying it.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, you guys can laugh or cry about that. But nonetheless, this episode's gone on long enough, and I can say that we are done now at this point. So I'll just give everybody a reminder that if you want full show notes, that's at update.rsbnb.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast, have it delivered automatically to you on Apple, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, YouTube, practically anything, update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. We'll be back next week with the encore of the Lore Diggers episode. This time we'll be talking about Orthyn, and we'll be taking any questions that sum up archaeology lore. Can be about any of the dig sites. You know, this is going to be effectively our wrap-up of archaeology coverage for the skill launch, believe it or not.
Yeah, what a year it was.
So that's going to be a real fun episode. So if you want to give that a listen, that'll be out next week. We'll have questions associated with it and so much more. Diana will be there. We'll have a very fun episode. And, of course, you guys are probably aware that this is going to be our last regularly live episode before the year ends. So I'll just take a moment to say Merry Christmas to everybody out there. But we are not taking a break. Next week on Christmas Eve, we will launch our Lore Diggers episode. And the week after that on New Year's Eve will be, of course, the Clip Show, the 2020 Clip Show. We're finally here, everyone, and you know it's gonna be a good one. We've already got that all put together. It's gonna be fun to go through. You know, hard to believe that some of the stuff we were talking about there was 2020. Thinking back to it, just in terms of
I hear the laughs what a year in that been. Episode are quite infectious.
Where'd you hear that from?
That's a joke.
Oh, okay. Infectious. Oh, right. Whoops. Yeah, see? And that's just like one of the clips. I completely forgot that they were making reference to a plague soup at the Halloween event. And, you know, what a year to be making reference to a plague soup in the year that a plague is actually sweeping the world.
Right. It must be nice listening back to the carefree people recording episodes back in January and February of 2019.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see how that goes and how that pans out. But in any case, we'll be back next week. We're not taking a break. And we'll see you guys next week for another episode of RSBNP Updated. I'm just going to leave that one in there, Tanis. It is what it is.
2020. See you guys.
See ya.